Hello, everybody. Welcome to the 100-Year Real Estate Investor. We're your hosts, Jake and Gino, and this is the show dedicated to long-term personal financial engineering. G-Dad, how's it going?
Jake, doing great, bro. How you doing?
Always making it happen, big man. Our guest today is the founder and CEO of The Real Asset Investor and has acquired more than $350 million in real estate investments since 2010. Today, we're going to discuss how long-term thinking has made a positive impact on his business. So without further ado, Dave Zook, welcome to the show.
Jake, Gino, thanks for having me back.
It is our pleasure. And we were bantering a little bit before we got started here, but please describe for the folks your typical self-storage investment and what you're doing right now.
Yeah, so as you can imagine, as you know, there's a bunch of different ways you can make money in self-storage. Our business model is we are the bridge between the mom and pop operator and the institutional buyer, the REITs. So give you an example, we'll go in and buy an asset, a self-storage facility from a mom and pop. Oftentimes we're taking that, you know, 50 to 60,000 square foot facility. We're adding 20 or 30,000 square feet to it, climate controlled most often. We do a lot of business in the Southeast. We're then restabilizing that whole complex, getting that NOI built up, and then turn around and sell it to a REIT. We're projecting a 6-year hold, but our history tells you that it's, you know, likely going to be a 3.5 to 4 year hold.
No, that's beautiful. So where do you see the runway with this, and how has long-term thinking impacted your business?
There is an incredible amount of REIT appetite in the self-storage space. So I think of myself as a long-term investor, long-term buy and hold, long-term, you know, kind of forecast. But from a perspective of when you have the opportunity, you're sitting on a stabilized asset and you have the opportunity to sell that asset in a 4 cap. If you're not selling it at a 4 cap, you're buying it at a 4 cap, right? So we just can do a lot better than buying a stabilized asset than at a 4 cap. So, you know, these assets would work very well to hold in a long-term, you know, to take the long-term approach and hold it in our portfolio for a very long time. We could do a number of things. I mean, obviously in a real estate deal, you want more than one exit strategy. We could hold this thing. We could refi it. We could, you know, play the infinite game. We could, you know, just hold it in our portfolio for a long time. And it would be an attractive asset to do that. It's just not our strategy because of the kind of money the REITs are throwing at a stabilized asset.
So do you think if something happens to the economy or to the REIT appetite, you will be able to shift your model then?
Oh, for sure. These are highly desirable institutional grade assets. And, mm-hmm. you know, like I said, we've got multiple strategies. If the REIT appetite would go away tomorrow, we would be happy to hold some of these assets that we're selling to them.
Mm-hmm. Dave, what do you do that other people don't in relation to long-term thinking? What do you think you do?
I've got this thing. I've actually talked about it in a couple of the events that I was speaking at lately. And that is most people will give up what they want most for what they want now. I'm much more interested, whether it's an asset, whether it's a relationship, whether it's a partner, whatever that is, I'm much more interested in, okay, What's this going to look like after we've done, not just after we've done this one deal together, but after we've done 10, 20, 50 deals together. And it's the same way with an asset as well. You know, I'm not so much interested in a one-off. I didn't get into the self-storage space to play small and to just get into an asset. I got into the space because I felt like it was an asset class that we could scale. Mm-hmm. I felt like there was lots of wind in the sails of the asset class. The REIT appetite was just sort of developing over that time, and we've seen that grow considerably. So being able to invest on my conviction rather than like what's right in front of me in the moment, that's part of the long-term thinking. You know, sometimes you got to suffer through the current. And when you're investing on your conviction, sometimes you got to suffer through your current environment to get to the other side, to get you to where you think it's going.
Mm-hmm. That's very, very true. Core values has made a huge impact on our business. In the beginning, we kind of poo-pooed it. At least I did, because I came from a somewhat, you know, good corporate culture that turned toxic. So I'm just curious, has values-based decision-making and core values impacted your business at all? And if so, how?
It has. And I will tell you, as you guys know, being in this space, syndicating, working with investors, if you go to the market and it's all about you, you can probably get a couple deals done. You can probably do okay. But if you go to the market thinking, okay, how am I going to make this a win for my partners? How am I going to make this a win for my investors? What's in it for them? If I develop a business model that works very well and that we're aligned on, and I take that to my investors and I've developed the business model. And then once we got the business model set up, and I can go to work and just get some deals done, just get some work done and make it all about how can I deliver maximum value to my partners and investors. You never had to worry about the money. The business model is set up and now you just got to go and get the work done. So from core values, if you have the attitude that you want to add value to your investors, to your customers, to your vendors, to the people you're doing business with, that's how you get momentum. You never have to worry about where the money is going to come from, because if you do a really good job on those things and relationships, build those relationships, build strong relationships, never got to worry about the money.
Dave, let's go back years ago when we first met, you were in multifamily. When did you pivot from that short-term mindset and how did your life change once you did that? Because you were back in Pennsylvania, you're building chicken coops, you're building barns and all that. It was more of a mom and pop shop. Walk us through that whole transition of going that, get into multifamily and adopting that long-term mindset.
I'll tell you how I made the pivot. I made the pivot because I was being taxed to death. You know, I didn't know the difference. I didn't know the difference between going out and doing a short-term flip or making a hard money loan or getting into passive investments, and specifically passive investments with, you know, bonus depreciation, cost seg, you know, all that stuff. So I got pivot or I made the pivot because I got spanked. And I got spanked with $500,000 tax bill. And so when I, you know, I was building businesses.
That's one way to call me daddy, right? Ouch.
Oh, man. Yeah. So, you know, I made the pivot after I got spanked. And, you know, it was one of them things where I was having all kinds of fun running my businesses. I was building my businesses. Got to the point where they were very successful. And all of a sudden, here I am, ended up with having to give almost half my money back to the government. It just wasn't so much fun anymore. So I made the pivot after I figured, you know, after I had to pay my big tax bill.
And then from there, did you start buying multifamily? Is that the first iteration, gutting into multifamily and start looking at all those tax benefits, looking even at the cash flow and the depreciation and all that? Was that your next step?
Yeah. So I got into the real estate space when I figured out that real estate was more than just building streams of income, building longer term equity growth. It was a tax protection vehicle. Mm-hmm. And I went from paying $500,000 in tax the 1 year, more than a decade ago, to zero the following year. And today, you know, I make multiples amount of income that I did back then, and my tax bill is still zero or very close to it. So yeah, I used multifamily. Of course, it was a fast learning curve, and it had to do with the people I got around, had to do with getting mentors. I mean, I paid more for my mentors and mentorship programs probably than most people pay to put themselves through Harvard, the ones that make it, but it was worth it. I mean, it was a crazy learning curve, but you know, I learned about cost segregation. I mean, I learned about stuff I couldn't even spell before. I learned about cost segregation. I learned about bonus depreciation. I learned about, you know, if you go out and buy a piece of real estate and use debt and then use the bank's money and then cost segregate on top of that and use bonus depreciation. When I figured that out, my one question was like, wait a minute, how is this legal? It was a short learning curve, but I was highly incentivized to do it because I just had to part with $500,000 and I didn't want to do that again.
So I'm going sure from a nice pain, ROI there. Yeah, right.
Pain to pleasure. I love that. That is awesome.
You know, when you learn the most, right? When you're going through pain, you learn the most when you're going through extreme amounts of pain or extreme amounts of pleasure, probably more so pain. But for me, it was pain. I mean, I had to learn quickly and I was desperate to do it.
Hey, Dave, any experience in your life with people that were trying to get rich quick, or we call it the get there itis syndrome? You know, people that are like, I'm just going to pencil whip a deal, trying to put deals under contract. And, you know, have you had any experience there? And if so, you know, how did that work out?
Yeah, I mean, I hear it all the time. You know, somebody is trying to find that next altcoin, or that, you know, the next cryptocurrency that's going to go from, you know, 2 cents to $20.
Computer pictures, you know, going for $300,000. I don't even still know what the hell that shit's called, but anyways, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, that's, you know, and even in our own funds that we put out there, you know, I can show somebody a, you know, the deal that I just told you about, where we sold our 26 properties, self-storage properties, to a REIT for $450 million. And we made a, you know, our investors made a 30%+ annual cash return. I could show that deal to investors all day long. And I could show them that, look, you make your money in the exit. You make your money in, you know, 3 to 4 years from now. You know, this is a value add fund. You don't make a lot of money in the first, you know, 2-3 years. Mm-hmm. You make it in the end. Or I could show them a deal like, look, in 3 months, you'll start making a, you know, a 15% cash on cash return, where your total annualized cash return will be, you know, 19 or 22%, not 30, 31. They'll take the latter every day of the week. Give me that cash flow now. I want monthly cash flow. I want it now. I don't want to wait 3 or 4 years from now. That's a much easier sell. But so yeah, I see it all the time.
Let's talk about the cadence of accountability and your, when you started setting up your business. Now you've got multiple funds, multiple businesses. How was it, Dave, when you started scaling up? How do you get everyone on the same page? How do you start implementing systems into each one of your businesses? Give us an idea, because some people may be listening to this. They may only own 10 or 30 units, and they can't even fathom having a real estate fund, having a natural gas fund, having self-storage, having multifamily. What did you do when you started out? What was those couple of tips that you really utilized to start scaling up your businesses?
So for me, it's been pretty easy for me, because this sounds incredibly selfish, but this is something that I do for myself first. You know, I know how much passive income I've got to deal with when we're getting into Q4 of any given year. I know how much ordinary income I'm going to have for that year. And I know how much capital gains income I have for that year. So now I go to work and I got to figure out, okay, I got to find an asset class with the depreciation that will offset that income, that bucket of income. And so I'm doing that for myself. Mm-hmm. And then once I find an asset class that I love, now it's my job to find a partner that can deliver, and it's going to be a great partner with a great track record, who's been doing this for a long, long time. The kind of partner that's got the 10,000 hours, they're true professionals in the space. So I'm doing that stuff for myself. Mm-hmm. Once I find that asset class and I find that partner, now all I got to do is put a fund together and share it. So it's not really complicated. And of course, you know, we've got a bunch of different structures, you know, and many passive investors, even syndicators, are familiar with the, you know, the 70-30 split or the 80-20 split, or, you know, what that looks like. There's a different setup for different funds. And if you're in the natural gas space, or if you're in the self-storage space, I'm very familiar with that 70-30 split. But I'm also familiar with the 2-20 model, more of the hedge fund model, where you know, you get a little piece of the action on the front end for managing the fund, and then you get a piece of the action on the back end after the investors got all of their money back out of the deal. So in terms of setting up the deal, you just get creative with it. And of course, again, I live and breathe this stuff. I'm doing this stuff every day. So I think about different ways that, one, I like to reduce the risk for my investors. If we're getting into a new deal that we hadn't done before, and we talked briefly before the recording started about what I'm up to in the car wash space. The car wash space isn't new. Most people know about it, but it's new for us. So what I did there is we set up a debt fund, and we said to our investors, you make the first 1.75x. So you invest $100,000, you get $175,000 back. until that happens, I don't make a dime. So we set that up and projected a 5-year time frame when that'll happen. We believe it's going to happen much earlier than that. And I have every incentive in the world to make that happen in 3 years or 4 years, because until I do, I'm not making a dime. So, you know, just setting up different asset classes, and it may have to do with, I mean, I would venture to bet that most people who do their first multifamily deal is probably a little bit richer on the investor side than on the promoter side. I would argue that it should be. And then after you've done like 100 deals and you're Jake and Gino or you're Kenny McElroy, now you can, you know, you've proven yourself and you've taken a lot of risk out of that, out of the equation for your investors because of your track record, because you've been doing this a long time. You should have a little bit more on your side at that point. Mm-hmm. So just being able to have that flexibility and, you know, aligning yourself well with your investors when it has to do with risk or when it has to do with a new asset class that you're setting up and you've got some development in it or something like that. We're flexible and we love it.
And natural gas, ATMs, multifamily, self-storage. I think you said that thing that Superman's allergic to, you threw that out there as one of the precious metals too. You know, you're just doing it all. Any experience with whole life? You doing whole life for yourself and pulling out and reinvesting there?
I have been a whole life. I've done that for more than a decade now. So yeah. Yes, I've done that for a long time. In fact, just within the last 6 months, I had for the first time, I got a premium finance life insurance policy put on myself. So it was one of the things where I knew I wanted to do it and I knew enough about it that I knew I wanted it, but it was also one of the things that's kind of easy to not do and just shelf. We'll get that to some other time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's been on my radar for the last, you know, 2-3 years and just never got it done until just about 6 months ago, we got it done.
So explain to the listeners why you're bullish on whole life and why everyone should have it. Not Jake made this point. Everyone that we speak to that has at least an 8-figure net worth, every single person that has that 8-figure net worth has a whole life policy. When you start going down into the lower net worths and the middle class, they all shun it. But everyone who is a high income earner, high net worth, has whole life. Why do you love whole life?
I think it goes right along with the question that you asked right at the beginning of the show. And talked about long-term thinking. Mm-hmm. You talk about building wealth over the long term and being able to shield some of your assets, being able to have, you know, it provides, that one vehicle provides a number of different things. Mm-hmm. And when you're talking whole life and maybe even specifically, you know, premium financed whole life, I mean, you're taking on, you're able to leverage the bank's money to get what you want, and you're able to have some asset protection. You're able to accelerate your wealth inside the insurance vehicle. I mean, there's just a whole lot of things to like about whole life policies.
And the dual asset, you pop it in, you pull the money out, put it into a real estate deal, and you keep the party going. So G-Dad, wrap us up here. This has been a lot of fun. And Dave, I appreciate it.
So Dave Zooks starts out building his businesses. I know he was doing the chicken coops back then. He was doing barns. He was selling a lot of stuff, furniture.
He was working everything with the Amish at one point too, right? I think I remember that from back in the day. I could be wrong. I don't know.
Well, I'm sitting on my second floor office, and there's about 100 Amish guys running around on the floor right downstairs.
There you go. I wasn't wrong.
Yeah, and in that second floor office about a decade ago, he opens up an invoice from the IRS and it says 500 G's, baby. You better pay, you know? And he looks at it and goes, what the hell am I doing here? I'm paying the wrong person. The money's going the wrong way. It should be coming my way, not that way. So Dave says, you know, I got to look. And most of us would say, well, what do I do? I got to pay this. No, he was actually proactive. He took the long-term thinking. He saw the problem as an opportunity. And that's what happens. You stop and think, you ask yourself the better question. The better question is, how do I reduce this? What do I need to do to reduce it? And then your brain starts thinking proactively, goes to that first asset class and starts reading it, and probably had the wherewithal to think as I did, is this stuff even legal? Like, why isn't everybody doing this? Because it does take work. It does take time. You have to go out there. You have to learn the space. As Dave said, he spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on mentorship and investing in himself. Ultimately gets into the multifamily space. He goes to speak at MM1, then MM2, and then ultimately starts getting into other assets. He's becoming a real-time multifamily entrepreneur, getting into the ATM space, getting into the self-storage space. He's probably got NFTs in his future as well. And I know
that's what I was thinking of. I couldn't think of that. Yeah, that's right.
He's got all that in the future. But right now, he's playing in the self-storage and that long-term thinking, whether he uses self-storage or uses crypto or uses ATM, that is what's driven his success for the last decade and will continue to drive his success. And the whole life policies, throw that on top. That's just another layer. Those are just all assets. He's investing in all different types of assets and utilizing them as efficiently as possible and deriving the tax benefits from all of these assets.
And when you start playing those assets against each other to become tax efficient, like say, for instance, if you have an asset that you can invest in that gives you a high cash flow, it gives you, you know, high rate of return, but it has no depreciation value. Let's just say, I mean, whatever, let's call it a, you know, 20% annualized return on a private money loan with a first lien. Okay, no tax benefits whatsoever. Okay. And then you take an asset that you can invest in that has 100% bonus depreciation. And then you bring those two assets together. Now the 100% bonus depreciation wipes out the tax liability on both incomes. When you start playing those asset classes and start using those asset classes to offset the tax liability on each other, I mean, that's where the magic happens. I mean, that's where you get the momentum. And I think it starts with, you mentioned a couple of things. One of them was, how can I do this? Like oftentimes people think a certain way about a certain thing. And they're thinking, you know, things like, well, if you make a lot of money, you got to pay a lot of tax. Conventional thinking, right? I mean, it's about asking the question, how can I? That keeps your mind active. It keeps that door open instead of kicking it shut, saying, oh, my dad said I can't do that. Or my CPA said I can't do that. Or nobody else is doing that. You know, it just keeps your mind open. And then thinking outside of that conventional box. You know, just think, you know, and I don't even know the dictionaries, you know, how it describes conventional. But when I think of conventional, when I think of conventional wisdom, I'm thinking about, okay, what are 95% of people thinking? What are the masses doing? And that's what you want to turn. Well, that's when you want to turn around and turn, look around and say, okay, what else is there?
Mm-hmm. Love
that. Dave, really appreciate your time today. You know, entertaining as always. And Gino, great job. So gentlemen, we'll see you next time. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.